is Monday, April the 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, Japan hosting the G7 ministers concerned about China and North Korea.
The two countries don't have a good crisis management measures or channels of communication. The crisis may escalate in an unexpected way, so that's what Japan is really worried about.
Also ahead, ceasefire in Yemen, big change in Ukraine politics, and fierce campaigning ahead of the next U.S. presidential primary. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and other group of seven foreign ministers today, the second day of their meeting in Hiroshima, visited the Peace Memorial Park, a World War II memorial. U.S. dropped an atomic bomb on Japan 71 years ago in Hiroshima, which led to the end of the war. On day one of their talks on Sunday, the refugee crisis, political instability in the world, and global security were focal points. Among the security issues discussed was North Korea's threat to the region and to the world. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Ritzmacon Asia-Pacific University scholar Yoshiro Sato about Japan's concerns regarding Pyongyang's agenda.
There have been signs that the North is testing new missiles, and they also announced that they developed a new booster for a ballistic missile, which suspectedly makes improvement to North's ability to launch missiles against the U.S. mainland.
What does Japan want the U.S., if anything, to do about North Korea?
Well, Japan collectively with the United States supported the new U.N. sanctions, which tightens containment of North Korean effort to develop nuclear weapons. So Japan wants U.S. to take tough measures against North Korea. And what Japan is afraid is, like near the end of President George W. Bush's term, the United States may suddenly shift to a dialogue with North Korea with a positive, not negative, inducements. And this will leave Japan kind of unprepared, and Japan feels isolated because Japan cannot quickly shift to soft measures.
And on South China Sea, and East China Sea for that matter, what are Japan's concerns about China?
Well, Japan's concerned that China continues to develop the new gas field in the disputed water, and China also continues to deploy public patrol boats into the territorial water around the dispute, well, what China calls disputed, the Senkaku Islands. And all these provocative activities by China may lead to a sort of a standoff against Japanese Coast Guard or even the Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Force in the area. And because the two countries don't have a good crisis management measures or channels of communication, the crisis may escalate in an unexpected way. So that's what Japan is really worried about.
Of course, Japan is hosting this G7 summit coming up later this year. President Obama, of course, and other world leaders expected to be there among those seven biggest democracies in the world. This obviously is going to put a focus on Japan.
Sure. Yeah, this is a very important event for Prime Minister Abe to showcase Japan's role, and especially Japan's membership in the G7, Group of Seven, which is supposedly the forum for the global leading countries. And as China's rise has somewhat cast shadow on Japan's regional leadership, this is very important for Japan to demonstrate to the world that Japan is part of G7 and China is not. And in that sense, this is also important because the visit to Hiroshima this year symbolizes the solidarity of the Western world, and this really contrasts the last year's efforts by China and Russia to turn the 70-year anniversary of the World War II's end into some sort of propaganda to claim that both China and Russia were victors of the World War II, therefore they were entitled to take major part in the global management of international relations. So Japan is actually given the opportunity to kind of reverse that this year.
Yoshiro Sato is a professor at Ritsumeikan Asia-Pacific University. That's in Beppu, Japan. He spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty. A new ceasefire took effect in Yemen at midnight local time, with all sides promising to stick to it. Several other ceasefires in Yemen have failed in the past, and desperate civilians say they hope this one will last. A Saudi-backed coalition launched airstrikes against the rebel Houthis, who took over Sana'a in 2014 and forced the internationally backed government of President Abu Rabu Mansour Hadi to flee into exile. Airstrikes and fighting on the ground has killed more than 6,000 people and created a humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen. United Nations says more than 80% of the Yemeni civilians are in desperate need of food and medical aid. For reaction to the Yemen ceasefire, VOA spoke with Australian National University Arab and Islamic Studies scholar Amin Saikal.
Well, I think this ceasefire comes very much hot on the heel of the ceasefire in Syria. And that ceasefire seems to be holding to a large extent. And I think that has also put a lot of pressure on the various warring parties in Yemen to give it a more serious go at this time. That is one reason, and I think there is also another reason, and that is that neither side has really gained a lot of grounds against one another. I mean, the Saudi-led coalition and its support for the President Hadi's government, which has been kicked out of Sana'a since 2014, has not really made an enormous inroad in terms of defeating the Houthis, and the Houthis have not lost as much ground to the Saudi-led coalition as been claimed by the Saudis. And at the same time, the cost of this war has been escalating in both human and material terms for both sides. Some 6,000 or more the Yemenis have been killed, many, many more injured, and a lot of properties destroyed. And yet, neither side has been able to inflict a heavy blow or a fatal blow to one another.
That's Amin Saikal of Australian National University. He says the current truce in Yemen is aimed at giving peace talks scheduled for April the 18th in Kuwait a chance to succeed. Also in the news, Ukraine's embattled Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk said Sunday he's resigning, opening the way for a new government to be formed in an effort to end Kiev's political crisis. For some perspective on why Yatsenyuk is leaving office, VOA spoke with Indiana University scholar Elizabeth Dunn Cullen.
I think right now the biggest issue is that economic aid to the country has been severely stalled. The World Bank was due to give a second tranche of funding, $1.7 billion, was due to come out last October, and they have held back because of corruption in the government. So as long as there was this deadlock between the president, Poroshenko, and the prime minister, Yatsenyuk, and as long as both of them were widely accused of corruption, the World Bank was going to refuse to release that money. And that has now caused a really epic economic crisis in Ukraine.
And on the idea that corruption could be a factor for Ukraine's crisis, Dunn Cullen says that is part of it.
Well, I think it is a mistake to think of any of these politicians as particularly ideologically motivated. They are all interested in getting both power and profit. And in fact, the Panama Papers that just came out showed that the president, Poroshenko, himself has a great deal of offshore investments. Yatsenyuk was accused of embezzling about $325 million, and he's been in a massive spat with Mikhail Saakashvili, the former president of Georgia, who was brought into Odessa to do reforms. And Saakashvili has said loudly that the pace of reform is extremely slow, almost zero, and that the reason that there has been no reform is that those people in power at the national level have too much financial interest in keeping things the way they are because they're able to embezzle so much money.
Indiana University scholar Elizabeth Dunn Cullen. Early elections could be called if Ukraine lawmakers fail to unite behind a new prime minister, but President Petro Poroshenko has sought to avoid new voting for fear of further destabilizing the country. Kiev's forces have been battling pro-Russia separatists for control of eastern Ukraine for 2 years now, with more than 9,000 fighters and civilians killed in those clashes. At the same time, Moscow annexed Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula, and it remains under Russian control. Still ahead, dealing with Ethiopia's drought and the crisis it's creating. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. In Ethiopia, at least 6 million children are facing critical food shortages as a result of the worst drought in 50 years. This is the conclusion of the international charity organization Save the Children. The group's new chief executive, Helle Thornton-Schmidt, is on the ground there in Ethiopia. She says families are on the move searching for food and water, and she urges the international community to act now to further suffering or end the suffering for children and the risk of malnutrition and as well as waterborne diseases. Thornton-Schmidt spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis about the desperate situation in Ethiopia.
What I saw yesterday was hungry and thirsty children who are very much at risk of being malnourished. It is predicted that up to 500,000 children would be malnourished in 2016. And what we're urging now, the international community, is to come forward. Because what we have here in Ethiopia right now is a government that's trying its best. Ethiopia has changed very much over the last 20 years. They're trying their best. They're putting a lot of money behind this. But they can't do this alone, and more than 10 million people will be seriously affected. We still have a chance to prevent this. We have a chance of preventing that an emergency becomes a disaster, but we have to act now.
What areas did you travel in yesterday?
I traveled to City Zone, and this is an area that is highly affected. It is unfortunately not the only area that is affected. But what we're seeing right there, and the people I met yesterday, were people who have lost their livelihood. I spoke to a woman, Habiba. She had lost 40 goats. They were dead because they can't live when there's a drought either. Her 6 children was ill. They had fortunately come to the center where we can help people. And what is so worrying about this is that we can predict that this is going to happen if we don't act now. And it is very clear that even though the Ethiopian government are doing everything they can, they won't be able to tackle this issue on their own because of the sheer scale of this situation.
Also, I understand a large number of families, they're moving, trying to find food and water.
First, a lot of these families are nomadic families, and they're trying to move first to try to find water and food. But what happens to them is that their animals simply die, and when that happens, they have nothing to live on. And luckily, many of them will find the centers where we can help them. Yesterday, I witnessed that we are looking at the children that they bring in to see if they're malnourished. If they are, we are able to help them. We also provide schools for them because, of course, it's hard to get to schools. So we try to help as much as possible. We have a severe situation. When we sit here today and can look at 6 million children that require food aid.
Also, there's a big concern right now for waterborne diseases. So how is this issue being addressed?
Yeah, this is another issue that when you have hunger and not enough water, you always run the risk of having waterborne diseases. We're trying everything we can to remedy that and also educate people better for trying to avoid waterborne diseases. But when you have a lot of people who are hungry and thirsty, I mean, move very far to get water, you have a serious risk of waterborne diseases, even though we're trying to help as much as we can.
What do you see in the months ahead between April and August, where the hunger season supposedly will peak?
Well, we're seeing things getting worse because it is very hard to imagine that it could be better in the coming months. Even though there might be rain in the weeks to come, we will still have a situation where livestock is dead, where families are left completely without anything, nothing to eat, nothing to drink. And of course, it's obvious that that can cause huge risk to children. So we are seeing that particularly when we enter what we call the hunger season, that we will see the situation deteriorate. But it is my message to the world is that it's not too late. We can prevent the suffering of children if we act now. And we also have to remember that even though Ethiopia is a well-functioning country, there's peace and stability in Ethiopia, it is also a country that is hosting 750,000 refugees as it is right now. So the last thing this country needs is more people on the move and a general unstable situation.
Helly Thornton-Schmidt is Save the Children's chief. She spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis. By the way, Kim is host of our program, Africa News Tonight. The next U.S. presidential primary contest more than a week away, and there is no lull in campaigning as frontrunners in both parties look to increase their delegate leads, and challengers are arguing that the nomination could still be within their reach. VOA's Michael Bowman reports the all-critical delegate math is far more straightforward in the Democratic Party than for the Republicans.
Republican Ted Cruz and Democrat Bernie Sanders won big last week in Wisconsin, but face tough odds next week in New York, Donald Trump's home state.
It's great to be home. This is home.
And the state Hillary Clinton once represented as a senator.
Whoa! Hello, Sunset Park! Hello, Brooklyn!
With time dwindling to overtake the frontrunners in the delegate count, challengers are waging battles of perception. Sanders insists he retains a path to the nomination.
If we can win here, it absolutely opens the door to a path toward victory to the White House. When that voter turnout is high, we win.
Cruz, meanwhile, is making a more complicated argument that he could win the nomination even if he trails Trump in delegates heading into the Republican National Convention in July.
If we go into a contested convention, we're going to have a ton of delegates. Donald is going to have a ton of delegates. I think we will go in with an overwhelming advantage. I believe the first ballot will be the highest vote total Donald Trump receives, and on a subsequent ballot, we're going to win the nomination and earn a majority.
After a poor showing in Wisconsin, Trump shook up his campaign staff, but his rhetoric is unchanged.
You know, Lion Ted Cruz came today. He couldn't draw 100 people.
Clinton, meanwhile, says she is impatient to wrap up the Democratic contest so she can focus on the general election.
We are on the path to the nomination, but I need to win big here in New York because the sooner I can become the nominee, I can turn and unify the Democratic Party, and the sooner we can go after the Republicans full time.
Polls show Clinton and Trump with substantial leads in New York. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
And staying with U.S. politics, we turn to International Edition social media expert G. Abby Lee. Hi, G. What's the big story today?
Hi, Steve. Remember when we talked about Florida Governor Rick Scott getting yelled at a coffee shop earlier this week? He released an ad as a response to that criticism, and that's been trending on social media all weekend. The ad is on YouTube, and it's titled, Latte Liberal Gets an Earful. The video starts with voiceover that says, "You may have seen this video of a terribly rude woman at a coffee shop cursing and screaming at Governor Rick Scott." And the video goes on to counter some of her criticisms.
Hey, gee, what about the general response? What was it like?
More than 5,600 shared that clip on Facebook alone and received nearly 9,000 replies. One of the top comments got 8,000 likes, and it reads like this. I am offended when a governor on Facebook goes on to discredit someone. You represent all people in the state, not just the ones you agree with. You are subject to protests and much more. If anything, this posting proves you are not representing all people. Very shameful. Many of the top comments shared similar sentiments, so it's quite safe to say the response is not very well received in Florida.
And what else out there is trending?
Former First Lady Laura Bush hinting at her support for former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is getting a lot of attention. It's quite unusual for a Republican to support a Democrat contender or vice versa. Bush was speaking at the Women in the World Summit and said she wants the next president to be someone who is interested in women in Afghanistan. Clinton, for her part, endorsed Bush's book on Afghan women. A couple of media outlets have reported on this, and the Esquire magazine shared the link to its article on Facebook. The caption reads, "At the very least, she seems to be in the hashtag Never Trump camp."
Yeah, very interesting. This takes bipartisan support to a whole new level. And what's the public response like?
Well, the support may not be very useful for Clinton because some are seeing it as the establishment supporting each other. One of the top comments claimed, deep down there is absolutely no difference between a Bush and a Clinton. Steve?
Yeah, I gotcha. Many thanks, G. That's our own social media guru, G. Abby Lee. By the way, you can follow G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman, and you can follow International Edition on Twitter at VOA _IE. Coming up, a Danish pop band making a big splash. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Astronomers from Vanderbilt and Harvard universities have discovered a binary star system nearly 10,000 light years from Earth, where it takes 69 years for one of its stars to eclipse the other. But once it does, the eclipse lasts for 3.5 years. The researchers described their findings in a paper that's been accepted for publication in the Astronomical Journal. This star system, which has no official name, has set a new record for having both the longest duration stellar eclipse and the longest period between eclipses in a binary system. Until this discovery, the previous record holder was Epsilon Origae, an eclipsing binary system that is only 2,000 light years from Earth. That star system's yellow giant star is eclipsed by its normal-sized companion, that's slightly bigger than our sun, for 640 to 730 days every 27 years. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Danish singer-songwriter Lukas Graham Forshammer has broken through with his hit 7 Years, which recently reached number 2 on the Billboard Hot 100 music chart. International Edition's David Byrd reports that the soulful pop band Lukas Graham has touched a nerve with its hit song.
Once I was 7 years old, my mama told me, go make yourself some friends or you'll be lonely.
Lukas Graham Forshammer says he always wanted to release his pop soul music in the United States. He had success in Europe and in Australia, but it wasn't until the hit 7 Years that the Danish-born singer saw his dream come true.
I've always wanted to release in America. That's where I believe the music belongs. The style and the eclectic musical mix that we've put together kind of belongs here. This is where most of the genres are from, all the rap and soul and rock and roll, most of it anyway.
Forshammer grew up in Christiania, Denmark, a self-governed neighborhood in Copenhagen known for Pusher Street, where dealers peddle marijuana. But it also has a tight-knit community, and he and his boys, bandmates Mark Lovestick Falgren on drums, Casper Dalgard on keys and Magnus Magnum Larsen on bass, are currently on a North American tour. Lukas says he wants to touch audiences with his music, and he can see from the stage when a song affects someone.
Like when I make people cry when I sing 7 Years or Better Than Yourself, Happy Home, You're Not There, all these big ballads about loss and pain and family and experience and life, I'm like, that person gets it. And if someone's not crying, I'll be like, okay, so that person hasn't gone through that experience yet. Give her 5 years. She'll get it. Eventually, everybody gets it.
The 27-year-old Danish singer says that the song 7 Years wasn't intentional. It grew out of a recording session when his producer was just playing some chords on the piano.
Rizzy Rizzy, my main producer, started playing the piano. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. And I just started singing, once I was 7 years old, my... And then he was like, well, that's good, keep going. And I'm like, once I was 7 years old, my mama told me go. And it's like, oh, yeah, that's good. And we just 3.5 hours later, the song was done.
Lucas Graham Forshammer studied law before deciding to pursue music. He says his experience growing up in Christiania made him want to make a difference in people's lives. But now he's doing it with his music. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Very nice. How about that? Thank you, Dave. Well, here you go. Danny Willett is only the second golfer from England to win the Masters Golf Tournament, which takes place here in the U.S. state of Georgia. Willett was one of only two players who managed a bogey-free round on the final day on Sunday, shooting a 5-under par 67. His four-round total was also a 5-under par after he had an even par for the first three rounds. But I tell you who's going to make all the news. You know he will be, the defending champion Jordan Spieth. He led for three rounds, but something happened on Sunday. It all went belly up, and so Jordan's not there, and I'm sure people will be talking about it for a long time to come. Listen, thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. The latest world news straight ahead. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Navy announced this month that it had seized a ship laden with illegal weapons in the Persian Gulf that were likely bound for Houthi fighters in Yemen. It was the latest in a string of illicit weapons shipments seized in the region by naval forces and assessed by the U.S. to have originated in Iran. Distributing illegal weapons is part of a pattern of destabilizing behavior by Iran that remains a challenge for the United States and its regional allies. In testimony before Congress, Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs Thomas Shannon said the United States has been encouraged by Iran's adherence so far to the commitments it had made under the nuclear deal with the P5+1, the JCPOA. But he noted that profound differences with Iran remain and continue to be addressed.
Iran's support for terrorist groups like Hezbollah, its assistance to the Assad regime in Syria, and to Houthi rebels in Yemen are at odds with core U.S. interests and pose fundamental threats to the region and beyond. That's why we have retained our sanctions related to Iran's destabilizing activities in the region, including its support for terrorism.
In addition, Undersecretary Shannon expressed concern over Iran's attempts to develop increasingly capable ballistic missile systems and said the U.S. would use all available multilateral and unilateral tools to impede the development of Iran's missile program. Iran's violations of the fundamental rights of its citizens were also cited by the undersecretary, who noted that rights-related sanctions are not subject to relief under the JCPOA, and the U.S. continues to vigorously enforce these sanctions. At a recent press conference in Bahrain, Secretary of State John Kerry urged Iran to change its destabilizing behavior. "We call on Iran," said Secretary Kerry, "to prove to the world it wants to be a constructive member of the international community and contribute to peace and security, and to help us end the war in Yemen, not prolong it. Help us to end the war in Syria, not intensify it. And help us to be able to change the dynamics of this region, which needs space to begin to breathe, to engage in full economic activity, put people to work, send people to school, do things other than constantly be caught up in the instability that comes with either sectarian or ideological extremism."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.